three practical ways to listen when you disagree fiercely with Simon Greer. Do you struggle to listen when you're in disagreement? How do you hold your presence, maintain your focus, when everything the other person says is the opposite of what you've come to believe? Do you get so angry that you lose track of your argument and theirs? Today's episode may be able to help you explore how to listen when you disagree. And if you know somebody else who struggles when they're listening in disagreement, why not share the episode with them? Deep listening, impact beyond words. G'day, I'm Oscar Trimboli, and this is the Apple Award-winning podcast, Deep Listening, designed to move you from a distracted listener to a deep and impactful leader. Did you know you spend 55% of your day listening, yet only 2% of people have ever been taught how? In each episode, we explore the five levels of listening. Communication is 50% speaking and 50% listening. Yet as a leader, you're taught only the importance of communication from the perspective of how to speak. It's critical you start to build some muscles for the next phase in how to listen. The cost of not listening? It's confusion, it's conflict, it's projects running over schedule, it's lost customers, it's great employees that leave before they want to. When you implement the strategies, the tips and tactics that you'll hear, you'll get 4 hours a week back in your schedule. I wonder what you could do with an extra 4 hours a week. A few months ago, I received this email from England, from Jane. It said, I was moved by this video. It's a message of integrity and a desire to equip young people with the skills of listening and open-mindedness, coupled with curiosity and courage to have the conversations with those that hold different beliefs to you.
People don't want to communicate across lines of difference. They want to hunker down with their friends where they feel safe and secure and validated. Shame on us for not equipping them to do something different.
In the show notes, you'll be able to access the 18-minute video. There you'll see people exploring a listening experiment between students from two different universities in the United States. One, a progressive liberal institution, and another, a conservative institution. This project is called Bridging the Gap. Jane, thanks so much for your message. After watching this video, I wanted to dig a little deeper. I reached out to Simon Greer, who was there at the birth of this idea, and he continues to spread this concept across many more higher education institutions across the United States. Simon is the founder of Bridging the Gap and the host of Courageous Conversations at the Nantucket Project in the United States. He's known as a social entrepreneur and has spent the last 30 years on the front lines of the most contentious social change and struggles. Let's listen to Simon.
What's the cost of not listening? That question almost brings tears to my eyes. The cost is so severe. The cost is immense in terms of civilization and democracy. How do you govern a country or a planet with lots of problems if no one's listening? Some of those problems are existential. Not listening is an existential threat. That's maybe on the policy, national, global issues. But it's also the cost of not listening on a spiritual level because I'm one who believes that the political crisis we face is undergirded by a spiritual crisis. And the spiritual crisis is about how comfortable and confident we've become with the other being the other and dismissible, and therefore a little less human than me. And to me, you know, I'm Jewish, so that story of once people are a little less human than other people, like it can cascade very quickly. And the act of not listening, you're not entitled to me listening to you because you're not quite as made in the image of God as me. You're not quite as much a citizen as me. You're not quite as worthy as me. On the spiritual level, I think it's, you know, the cost is pretty high. On the interpersonal level, oh my gosh, it's like when I'm too busy with my ridiculous phone to really listen to what my kids say, I just miss out on life. Like I just miss life in the stupid phone, and I'm not hearing these two kids who I love more than anything. I'm not hearing what matters to them. So not listening there is like interpersonally, familially. Once I came to believe that listening is a superpower, then sort of not listening is like kryptonite.
Simon, we'll spend a bit of time talking about the Bridging the Gap project, but take me back before that project, and what was the conversation that sparked the idea to create this project?
It's always dangerous when you're asked, take me back, because I could go back to my parents came to the United States on a boat. They came from England in 1965. And to really understand me, you have to understand the part of the Jewish left that I grew up in. I grew up on the Upper West Side in New York City and Manhattan when it was still pretty working class, middle class, heavily Jewish left. I went to a summer camp called Camp Kinderland. And when I say this to people, it was a Jewish communist summer camp. They're like, oh, you mean liberal? No, I mean a Jewish communist summer camp. Like my bunk was named Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney after the civil rights workers. And the music building was called Paul Robeson. In camp, at least in the US, at summer camp, there's usually like blue versus gray in the Camp Olympics. And at my camp, at Camp Kinderland, the teams were named after countries in anti-colonial struggle. So I was on Vietnam one year, and I was on Ivory Coast one year. I mean, I really grew up on the left, and I learned a huge amount from that. I didn't ever do that well in school, and for many years blamed myself if I had just applied myself better, if I had just tried harder, if you know, it was a problem with me. I don't think I had a framework to understand that maybe it was a problem with the institution. And when I was in college, I wrote my senior thesis about this place called the Highlander Center in Tennessee, which is a social movement training ground. Martin Luther King was trained there. Rosa Parks was trained there. The story I want to share is that in the opening to my thesis in college, when I wrote about Highlander, I quoted a woman I had seen at a workshop there who said, "Highlander learned me good." And what I loved about it was that it wasn't that they taught her, it was that they helped her learn what she knew. It helped her find her wisdom. Caveat, I failed my thesis because they said it was anti-intellectual, which exactly goes to my point about the problem with the institutions. But that aside, after I finished college, I went to Poland, which is the country my family had fled and many had perished in a couple generations back. But I went because I had a chance to go work for Solidarity when they became the government. My first job was working in Solidarity's headquarters when Lech Wałęsa was elected and became president of newly freed, newly independent Poland. And I learned a lot of things there. I learned what social movements are like on a mass scale because everybody was in the movement, in the revolution. I learned about how hard it is when you win. Like they toppled the Soviet Union, then they had to run an economy and a country, and that's not easy. As a 21-year-old, I got a dose. You got to be very serious about what it means to win. But the thing I think most relevant for our conversation is that what was seared into my heart was a deep faith in people, that everyday people can do great things. And that's actually probably the only people who can do great things, right? It's not just the smartest person, the most elite person, the most powerful. It's like the electrician and the plumber and the shipyard worker. And that we actually, as humans, want to do that. We want to be bigger than Like I just tended to my little life here. Like we want to make a mark, but most of us are told we can't. And the way our societies are structured, it's increasingly hard to. That launched me into a career as a community organizer and a union organizer. And the reason I dwell a little on the backstory is that over the years, the 90s into the 2000s, I was involved on the front lines and in deep ways in many of the most contentious political struggles in the country.
G'day, it's Oscar. I just wanted to have a quick chat with you. I could have interrupted Simon and said, let's focus on the backstory of bridging the gap, rather than continue on with his backstory. Focusing on bridging the gap would have been a great example of listening only at level two to the content. When you're open to listening at level three, where we're listening for the context, you take the time to listen to the backstory and to their backstory. As a result of listening to this backstory, you have a very different understanding and insight into who Simon Greer is. The backstory will make the rest of this discussion with Simon so much richer. And I suspect even more interesting for you. How comfortable are you to stay with the backstory just a little longer? How comfortable are you to ask people, do you mind going back to when this first started? You'll get a completely different conversation and they'll listen to themselves in a very different way. Let's jump from there into the White House.
I was active in the 2008 in President Obama's election.
Yes, we can to justice and equality.
I remember a couple days after President Obama was reelected, I was at the White House having breakfast in the White House mess with a friend of mine who was very close to the president. And I asked him how he was feeling after the re-election. And he said, I feel after 4 years like I can let my breath out. Like I can take a breath because the first African-American president won't be a one-term president. He'll be a two-term president. And I shared that breath with him. And I had a moment of thinking like, now isn't everyone going to do what he wants? Like the black guy got elected two times. It's protocol. Everybody does what the second-term president, like give him what he wants for 2 years. A week later, I had the rude awakening that was not happening. And it connected to, I don't know if it precipitated, but it all tied into like a rupture or an epiphany for me that there was something way deeper going on. This was not just about politics. And yeah, of course, race played a big role in it, but there was a lot going on in our country that was beyond my ability to understand. And the rupture part was that it dawned on me that I had become a social change agent who was convinced that everyone should change except me. That I was right, and if everyone would just be more like me, wouldn't we all be happier? And how unappealing that is. I had fallen into what my team, the progressive team, I'd fallen into the trap of who we had come to demonize or dismiss. I would say corporate leaders and the white working class were like two groups that weren't at home in the progressive movement. And they were often not viewed well in the progressive movement. And so I went out and I spent the next couple of years doing everything I could to hang around with those people. And I knew I would learn something about them. And turned out I learned a lot about me. What shifted in me was that maybe just out of desperation or exhaustion, I didn't go into any of those conversations trying to convince them of anything. I had just let go of needing to be somebody who had a position, who told people how to see it. And it returned me to, like, I have faith in people and everyday people. I'm going to sit down with this corrections officer from Michigan, or I'm going to sit down with this executive at this company, and I'm not going to think I know the right answer. I'm just going to listen. And when they tell me something that feels disagreeable, where I feel like that bubbling up of, oh, no, 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 I'm just going to do something different. I'm going to say, well, can you tell me more about that? Instead of, here's why you're wrong, dummy. You know, or, wow, what was that like for you? Instead of, I can't believe you did that. And though what started as those two simple moves, tell me more about that and what was that like for you, became like a dramatic, like 180 in my life and in my career. And the spiritual transformation was that I have more faith in people than I have certainty that I'm right. And rather than convincing people to be more like me, it's to be humble enough and curious enough about why they are the way they are. And that simple revolutionary shift is ultimately what gave birth to Bridging the Gap.
Simon, can you take us into one of those conversations?
It was with a corrections officer. It was a discussion now about what we should do with people who are incarcerated. There are too many people in prison. They're not treated well in prison. We need to invest more in their, it's called programming, like educational programming, helping them be prepared for when they get out of prison. And I was talking to a corrections officer, and every indication I had was that he was against programming. He would probably call it, it's called disparagingly among some people, hug a thug. If you just hug them and you're nice to them, won't they get their acts together? And so I was asking him about programming, and he said, you know, I'm a Christian, so I know that idle hands are the devil's playground. And I know when they're not busy, it's not safe. And I believe in redemption. I believe in second chances. I want them to be successful when they get out. So that was not exactly what I expected as the opening. He said, in many situations and in our prisons, the ratio of people who are incarcerated to corrections officers is about 100 to 1. We have 100 incarcerated people to one officer. He said in a housing unit, there might be 2 officers and 200 incarcerated people. And now they want us to run a program. They want me to leave my partner to go run this program. Now, they're not going to pay me anything extra or give me extra training, but I'm going to go oversee this program and leave him alone 200 to 1. But we're like the Marines. We don't leave anyone behind, and I will never leave him alone in there. It's not that I don't believe in programming. I just don't believe in the impossible choices that I've been given. And he said, you know, and here's the other thing. Like, no one's coming here offering programming for me. Like, I didn't get a college education. I didn't get access to all this. No one thought about that for me. And a lot of people who have never been inside a prison, they think these programs will work and this. They never asked me. I know who's trying to game the system and who really wants an education. I know it because I work here. There's people with all these big ideas about how they want to change the system, but they don't even think the guy who works here sometimes 16 hours a day might have a point of view about what works and what doesn't. And what dawned on me was that I was one of those people who have a lot of opinions about criminal justice and what's unjust about the system. And I almost had literally forgotten that it's a job for 400,000 people in this country who work in those prisons. And that if we're going to reform the prisons, which we should, shouldn't they be right alongside the incarcerated people at the center of it? He talked about how to do that job every day. You sort of tuck away your vulnerability. Like you can't live in that environment, work in that environment day in and day out, and just be open-hearted. So you tuck it away. And what I think the heart opening for me was, I don't have to do that job. So I can lead a little more vulnerably. I can be open-hearted and trusting because he and many people like him do a very dangerous job and I'm safer because of it. And instead of overlooking him, judging him, forgetting to include him, I might like say thank you that you're willing to do a job I would not want to do. And you pay the price physically, also mentally and emotionally. And so I don't have to. And the least I could do is like really take seriously how you see the world, because you're sacrificing so much and I benefit from it, and that I had missed that for so long.
I love the point Simon makes here about frontline workers and people on the edge of the conversation in the organization. I encourage a lot of the leaders I work with, when was the last time you asked the customer service staff in a contact center, the production workers, the construction crew, the shop front workers, the factory workers, when was the last time you sat down with them and had a genuine conversation? When was the last time you spent time with customers and suppliers? I think for many of us, we don't realize that people leave some listening breadcrumbs when they leave the organization. And I'm not talking about the exit interview. I think that's quite a formal process where people honestly don't tell you the truth. There's an industry that has emerged because of technology that allows people to review their own organization. One of the things I talk to leaders about is, when did you last look at your Glassdoor reviews? The Glassdoor is an organization that allows people to review an organization and their leader. I wonder what would be on your Glassdoor review if your organization was being reviewed, or your department or your team. I think for a lot of us as leaders, it takes courage to have the kinds of conversations that allows our team to tell us the truth. Simon is about to discuss a really courageous conversation where he paired together some Hillary voters with some Trump voters in a courageous conversation. Simon reinforces a point that we make, that the best listening cultures are the best storytelling cultures, and stories can be sometimes more influential than just the facts.
What started to happen was I was listening in these conversations with people who were from a different walk of life than me, and it was changing my world. I was starting to think about things I hadn't. It wasn't just that I was no longer trying to convince them. I was learning that I didn't know things. I had simplified problems and solutions, and they were complicating them. And I was no longer fighting that they would adopt my values. It was like, oh, that's an important value too. I go, huh, no, I'd overlooked that one. One day I literally said, we should have more people engage in these courageous conversations. And I just was trying to have honest conversations with people who disagreed with each other. And I guess today that's called courageous conversation. I did this exchange program that eventually gave birth to Bridging the Gap, where we took conservative Trump supporting corrections officers from Michigan, and we teamed them up with liberal Hillary supporters from New York City. And they went and lived with each other. They had these courageous conversations, and it started to develop like a practice. I started to try to unpack, what is it that I'm doing differently here? So a lot of it was about listening. We started teaching listening. A lot of it was about telling stories rather than giving facts. We started teaching storytelling. A lot of it was the art of feedback, like not blurring that I disagree with you, but how do I do that constructively? And so we started teaching that. So then those were like the foundational skills of how to have courageous conversations. And there was this deeper invitation. I just scribbled it one day as part of inviting people to a meeting. And then it became like our hallmark. We say that we're inviting you to a conversation where we're going to take seriously the things that others hold dear. If it matters to you, it's going to matter to me. Because often we skip that part, right? Like, no, I want to talk about my thing, right? I'm not going to take seriously your thing. And then that we're not going to try to convince you you're wrong or try to change you. We're going to be curious why you think the way you think, which was a 180 from how I had lived my career. But I stopped. I let go of, I'm going to try to change you. I actually think people are more likely to change once you stop trying to change them. I'm not here to change anybody. I'm here to listen. I'm going to be curious why you think the way you think. And I'm going to believe that there's more common ground than we might expect. But in some cases, there won't be. And even when there isn't, I can respect you. And then this part I added at the end, but I can even love you when we have fundamental disagreements. And people are like, you can't put love in that, and you're selling out, and you're going to tolerate the racists. And well, if we're not making change, what are we doing? And I heard all that, but I actually thought, it's like, well, if we don't love the people, I don't think we're going to get anywhere. And if we don't take seriously the things that they care about, why would they take seriously anything you care about? And if convincing them was so easy, we would have won. But I just want to understand them. That became the invitation and then the building blocks of Courageous Conversations. And then through my friends at the Nantucket Project, I got these interesting opportunities, particularly with Sean Spicer right after he left the White House, and then with Glenn Beck, to have these very hard conversations across lines of difference, which we called Courageous Conversations. And all of that then eventually gave birth to Bridging the Gap, which is the campus application of all that work.
Simon, can you with me explore this tension between listening to differences versus listening for differences?
In the Jewish tradition, there's these two kinds of arguments, arguments for kind of the sake of self or arguments for the sake of heaven. And the arguments for the sake of self, like I'm trying to win to make my point. The arguments for the sake of heaven, essentially, I'm trying to illuminate the truth. The rabbis who are having those arguments for the sake of illuminating truth, they have a shared tradition. And I think one of the things that challenges us sometimes in listening is we don't trust that the tradition I think I'm in and the tradition you think you're in have enough respect that they can coexist. And so why would I listen carefully, right, if I think you just want to annihilate me? But I think in the framework of the argument for the sake of heaven, the way I was originally taught and worked for decades, I pause my tirade long enough and I listen to you carefully enough so I can effectively reload and destroy whatever point it was you made. I did that. And I was pretty good at it for a long time. The problem is it just ends up with everything blown up and it doesn't yield that much change, I fear. In this approach, like I come in believing that I sometimes talk about this as strong back, soft front. I have some pretty deep clarity about my core values and how I try to conduct myself in the world, but I don't need to be aggressive with it. I'm not so afraid of it being of its fragility that I need to like knock you out first. And so I can listen with some confidence in who I am. I have some faith in people and what most deeply animates us. And now I can listen because I know there's big pieces of this puzzle I can't see. I want to hear how you think about it. And I guess to your point, I don't just want to hear where we disagree. I then want to mine it for everything I can. Like, how deeply do you believe that? Where did you come to believe that? Who did you hear that story from? Where did you read about that? Why does it matter to you? That's what I want to understand about the differences, because sometimes we're not that different. Right? We had similar experiences. You just made different meaning out of it. Sometimes we are really, really different. You're a really good person too, and you do the best you can as a dad. You just really see this stuff so differently. If you see difference / disagreement as a threat, then you're going to handle it in one way. If you see it as a gift, then you're going to handle it in another. In workplace settings, actually, I've argued for a long time that the wisdom that the mainstream of the company needs often lives in the margins of the company, but the mainstream doesn't know how to access it. Because in essence, it's signaled, don't rock the boat, don't tell us that, don't upset the boss or the boss's boss. And so there's all the answers lurking in the margins. We could fix production if we just listen to them. We could change the marketing if we just listen to them. But we signal to them, really, don't say it. That's a case where if you could change that culture so that the differences of opinion and experience and perspective of those people came to be invited into the mainstream, those differences would literally be gifts to the bottom line. Gifts, but they're treated like they're threats. And so they're escorted out more often than they're welcomed in.
Simon, let's talk about bridging the gap. How did it start? And how's it going now?
We did this exchange I talked about between the New Yorkers and the Michiganders, and that took on some very interesting twists and turns. I'd say one of the most moving parts was after the terrorist attack at the Tree of Life Synagogue, three of the corrections officers from Michigan, who they were all Christian and the New York group was all Jewish. They flew to New York on Shabbat, 2 weeks after the Tree of Life shooting, and they read a letter as conservatives about standing with the Jewish family they felt they had built through this exchange. And it isn't common practice to give standing ovations in synagogue. It doesn't really, people don't clap, but they got a standing ovation. And when they came, a member of the synagogue hosted them, one of them, the night they stayed over in New York. He said to me afterwards, his name's Dan Zucker, he asked if I'd ever thought about doing this on a college campus. I said, no, but I'm open. So Dan was an alumnus of Oberlin and had a daughter at Oberlin, or maybe two. And one of the people who had come from Michigan, his brother was a student at Spring Arbor University. And so Dan said, you know, would you try to do this on a college campus? I said, I'm happy to give it a shot. We pulled together Spring Arbor and Oberlin because we had those connections to do the first pilot. This past year, we did a pair of campuses, two schools, January a year ago, so 18 months ago, I guess. This past year, January through May, we did 9 campuses. Despite COVID, I would say it's growing, which was not easy to pull off. And I definitely think we lost something by doing it virtually, but we did it. And I think the demand is really growing for next year. So I imagine we'll try to do 20 schools next year. The thing that is worth sharing is that I didn't mean to shift to work a lot in higher education. It wasn't really my interest. As I said, I just wanted to do this experiment. But the students like captured my heart and captured my imagination. Because for all the talk on evangelical campuses and super liberal campuses that there is a cancel culture or call out culture and it gets in the way of the free exchange of ideas, I think that's true. But it's not what students want. They want something richer. But you know, it's like culture in a corporate environment or any, sometimes it's really hard to get your hands on why is this culture this way and what would you do to change it? And these students want something different. They want to go deeper. They want to really solve problems, not just grandstand. They want to like understand. And so there's something about them investing in these young people who will be our future leaders and who are in such a tough spot and want something different. Like if I could help be of service there, that would be a highest and best use of my time.
Is there a story that really stands out?
I walked onto Spring Arbor's campus. It's a Free Methodist school, evangelical Christian in rural Michigan. And I just assumed, like shame on me, that they're all gonna be white. And like the first students I met were all African-American. And I was like, oh, huh, you can be an evangelical Christian in rural Michigan and be an African-American woman. That's not what I pictured. Oops. So there's things like that. You know, every day we did a follow-on program at Oberlin this past year where we taught a class about racism and anti-Semitism. And there was a student in that program who, student of color, and she, as part of her project for our course, she went and did one-on-one conversations with like 5, 6, or 7 Jewish people in her life who she had never talked with about anti-Semitism. And she came back with like this deep, thoughtful understanding as an Asian American woman, how some of the struggles she has about where she fits and doesn't fit. She now saw that her Jewish friends also had some things that, of course, it's different because being Jewish and being Asian are different in America. And they're different. But there was more common ground than she had thought. And she is not someone who'd ever thought really about anti-Semitism before. There was the two students, one from one of the evangelical schools, one from one of the more liberal schools, and a guy from the more liberal school he was really at odds politically with this guy from the more conservative school. And but he was sharing something with him about a struggle he was having. And the more conservative student spontaneously said something like, you know, well, I'm going to pray for you. And he did. And this was unbeknownst to all of us. This happened like off in Zoom land. And in the last session, when people were talking about their highlights, the liberal, more liberal student said how deeply it touched him. He's not someone who has a prayer practice, but that this person he had just met, who saw that this person was struggling, just decided he would pray for him. And I think what meant so much to me about it was that the more liberal student took it to heart in such a way. He wasn't dismissive of prayer, like, I don't believe, and blah. Like he let it in, he let it touch him. And that there, he saw that there was something beautiful in this conservative Christian worldview, that if you care about someone and they're in pain, you pray. And that in this liberal ethos, maybe there wasn't a comparable offering. It isn't just that we should tolerate that, oh, they pray. It's like there's a function of that kind of an offering, and you don't have to believe in God, or you do believe in God, and it doesn't have to be a prayer. But there's something about that inclination, I care about you and I want to express it this way, is something that, you know, we'd all be better off if we had a little more of that in our lives, however we choose to do it. I think in all these cases, it was something about the way they, you know, it works. If you listen, if you share your story, if you give feedback skillfully, something gets touched and opened that allows you to access the wisdom, the beauty, the power, the connection that you wouldn't have otherwise gotten. And each story, and you know, it's every campus, every time, there are stories of people, whether it's their blossoming in leadership or feeling like they can speak on a topic that they've never spoken about, or that they can disclose that they have a point of view that's different than others, and that that's welcome. I just, over and over again, and that's why I stick with it, I think, because of the every time, even when I'm like, oh, I don't know if that worked so well. Like, I facilitated this conversation for these 8 students at Spring Arbor, 4 who were pro-life and 4 who were pro-choice. It's almost like I want to ring the bell. Like, that is not easy. It is an evangelical school. So for 4 students who are pro-choice to say I'm pro-choice, that risks social isolation. But we helped create a culture where they could. And then we trained them a little bit, and we structured the conversation so they were able to practice, like, I disagree with you. This is what they each had to do. They had to tell stories about how they came to see this issue the way they saw it. And then a student with a different viewpoint had to try to say, while I disagree with you, I understand why, from your point of view, that thing would really matter. And it's like, well, we could just do that in our government. You know, we might actually solve some problems. I think what's happened is we created the other, and we don't think we need to listen to them. And we actually think we're in a state of kind of perpetual war. So when we are arguing about, I believe it's true with pro-life and pro-choice, I believe it's true with climate change, with racial justice and law and order, that we've lost the spirit that we're like fellow Americans who have some big problems, and we're going to sit down together and try to solve them. And I don't mean to minimize that there are fundamental disagreements, and being too patient and too slow and kumbaya and mushy middle doesn't get us anywhere. So I'm not saying that, and I would hate to be dismissed as someone who thinks that it's all about soft, mushy compromise, because I don't. But instead of looking at these problems and bringing our best solution set to them, it's like the issue is the battlefield on which we seek to vanquish our mortal enemies. If you wanted to solve the racial justice, law and order tension, you would acknowledge that you can't have law and order without racial justice, and you can't have racial justice without law and order. And if you want an alternative to police intervening in a mental health crisis in a community in an apartment building, you'd get some social workers and some residents and some police, and you'd think together, well, that's complicated, because if you send a social worker and the mentally unstable husband has a knife, you actually would like a policeman there. But if you send a policeman into a crowded apartment building and all he's got is a gun, it's not going to go well. Like, you don't need to be ideological, right? But you could then listen to, well, what would the social worker do? What would the police officer do? What would the tenant do? And through the listening, you'd actually solve the problem, I believe. You'd come up with a good set of solutions, or at least experiments. But we're not trying to solve them. We're trying to fight the issue. We're trying to defeat our foe. And so we don't want to listen to what they know. We want to prove to our team that our foes are irredeemable. And I think that's, it goes back to your opening question. I think that's the crisis.
I knew this conversation would be special, paradoxical, and testing me. I love how open-ended Simon left the conversation, and I also love that he has a fundamental belief in people, and that if you put people together with the right tools and the right frameworks and the right kind of guidance, you can disagree and still listen to the other person. One of the things I took away from Simon's conversation today was the difference between arguing for truth or arguing for victory. It got me researching a little bit more about the Jewish Torah and the story of the Korach in terms of arguing for truth or victory. I discovered a resource from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. He explains that the argument for the sake of victory in a conflict, it's not for the sake of truth. It's for the sake of power. And the result is that both sides suffer. The rabbi says, if you win, I lose. But if I win, I also lose, because I'm diminishing you. And in diminishing you, I diminish myself. The argument for the sake of power is a lose-lose scenario. The rabbi continues and says the opposite is the case when the argument is for the sake of the truth. He says, if I win, I win. But if I lose, I also win, because I'm being defeated by the truth. And it's the only form of defeat that is also a victory. Since this interview with Simon, I've spent so much time thinking about arguing for truth versus arguing for victory. And I love the point that Jonathan made. It wasn't until he realized that he was listening while reloading his argument, only to fire back at the other person. I wonder what your takeaway from today's conversation, and more specifically, think of a conversation you've got coming up shortly, where you anticipate you may be in disagreement. Think about asking for more stories. And not that facts are unimportant, but I think too much time we spend time only with facts. And when we discover the stories that connect to the person's argument, we may have a moment of pause to listen to their argument. It's not that your mind is going to be changed. It's just you acknowledge that there are differences. I think it's no coincidence that the best listening cultures are the best storytelling cultures, whether that's in ancient or modern traditions. And finally, how does a backstory create the connective tissue between the past and the present and the future? I'm so glad I stayed with Jonathan, where he took me all the way back to his parents sailing out of England to arrive in the US, because it gave me a great sense of his place in the context of his family's history and traditions, and the logical connection that that made by telling a story. I love his point about, do you see disagreement as a gift or a threat? I'm Oscar Trimboli, and I'm on a quest to create 100 million deep listeners in the world, and you've given me the greatest gift of all. You've listened to me. Thanks for listening.
Hey.
Hey, Simon, just separately, if we did this interview all over again, what's the one question I should have asked that I didn't?
I think it's something about like the cost or the loss of taking this approach, or the self-doubt about taking this approach. Self-doubt is that like there's bad things happening, and you know, saying, well, we should just listen to them more, it just sounds ridiculous to me. It's like, really? Did you just say that, Simon? Like, you know, no, you don't. You like shut it down, you stop it. And so I've come to say more and more, like, safety and security matter. Like, you don't have a conversation just all the time. You get safe, right? Now, the caveat is, in some contexts, people now think an idea I disagree with makes me unsafe, and I don't sanction that. Disagreeable ideas are not dangerous to me, right? You can think the world looks different than I do. It's flat, it's round. I'm not unsafe because of that. But if you are threatening me, I need to get out of there before I talk about a conversation. So I think part of my feeling is like, you know, is it naive? Is it silly? Like, there are powerful forces out there sowing division and reaping the benefit of it, and I want us to listen better. You know, there's a part of me that thinks, not this time around. So that's my self-doubt talking, but that's serious. And so how to be effective in making change, but honoring that with the curiosity and the humility that goes with it. I think that's cost me some relationships where people are like, I don't want to deal with him anymore.